CDs collecting dust around your abode and bring them down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. Got questions? Contact Jesse at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. Remember, the stuff that you're sick of, others may treasure. Turn your clutter into cash for your community radio station, KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Portland Hawthorne Hostel's 11th annual Bike In Movie on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. The film will be True Fans, an award-winning documentary about an epic cross-country bicycle journey of three men traveling to the Basketball Hall of Fame and discovering the real America along the way. Musical entertainment will be provided by Train River, an eclectic collection of bluegrass and string band musicians. Again, that's the 11th annual Bike In Movie showing of True Fans on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net.
I can't believe it. We're flashing back to my ute.
To your ute.
I mean, this is so depressing. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
As well
dial.
As flashing back to idioms gone by.
Yeah, well, no, not so. Apparently not. Hey, this is the Abe and Joe talk radio show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. The number to call, 231-8187. Guess what? We're going to talk about Ferguson. And I've been watching. Yep. I've been watching.
Yeah, I have too.
It's pretty amazing, pretty disastrous.
Why don't you set it up for us? Set it up for us.
Well, look, this is a town that is about 2/3, maybe a little more than that, African American. It underwent a transition from white suburb to African American community. During that period of time, the government of the state, the government of Ferguson did not change. It is predominantly white. The police department is predominantly white. There are three persons of color, I believe, on the police department. A young man, 18 years old, was walking down the street with a friend in the middle of the street. And I have to make something clear to people about the middle of the street thing. I have seen lots of young people walk down the middle of the street. And I don't know whether it's a cultural issue or some other thing, but not exactly a serious crime. This one police officer stopped them, according to the three, and let's be clear about this, three witnesses, including, if it hasn't been destroyed, a video image of all of this. The officer had, he says, he, the cop, now he's the only survivor of this, says that the one kid tried to grab his gun, reached into his car, really unlikely tale, tried to grab his gun. There was a struggle. The kid left, and then he got out of his car, ignoring the other young man, and shot the kid.
Six times. Twice in the head.
Twice in the head, and the headshots indicate that he was probably going down when he was shot.
Witnesses, in contradiction to what the police officer said, witnesses say the young man was shot with his hands in the air.
Yeah.
That he did not try to reach into the car, nor did he try to take the officer's gun.
Right.
Yeah. And there are particulars to this story that are important, but this is also part of a much larger story, and that is that people of color have historically in this country often ended up dead at the hands of white cops, and more often than not, those white cops face no consequences.
Right. Well, right. Yeah. I mean, you have so many of these stories in our lifetimes. But what also is the case is that, and I'm thinking about the analysis of riot, which is sort of what happened after the killing. First of all, it was clear to anybody that what the police officer did was probably murder.
Probably.
And it is also clear that the way in which the police department responded to this was to hide all of that, to try to not acknowledge the officer's very possible wrongness in this case, and to essentially act like everything was cool. And the community was outraged. Remember that the young man who was shot, Michael Ferguson, lay in the street.
No, not Michael Ferguson.
What did I say?
You said Michael Ferguson.
Oh, sorry. Anyway, he lay in the street for 4 hours in the hot sun. Family wasn't allowed to go to his side, nothing. Paramedics weren't allowed to go to him. No effort was made to ascertain whether, in fact, he was dead.
Now, we talked just a second ago about this being part of a larger narrative that has wound its way through American life, and that is people of color ending up dead at the hands of white law enforcement officers. Now, that is itself not the entirety of the story. This is indicative of a much larger trend, and that is people of color, members of underrepresented communities, find all sorts of institutional roadblocks standing between themselves and some measure of economic prosperity, social stability, and equality under the law. And being shot by white police officers, while horrible, obviously, and perhaps the most extreme example of this, it's just part of this bigger story. People of color face obstacles getting registered to vote, turning out at the polls. It's harder to get loans. It's harder to get hired. Often find themselves in substandard public schools. And the list goes on and on and on and on. There are people in this country, particularly in the age of Barack Obama, who believe somehow that institutional racism has been legislated away, or that we have all turned over a much more enlightened leaf. But that's really not the case. In this example, this young man's death and the subsequent unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, is an indication that this is the case.
Yeah, and you know, back in 1968, after a series of riots, very violent riots all over the United States, including Portland, Oregon, by the way, the Kerner Commission was asked to look into what were the causes of all this, what are the root causes, and they came up with what now we would have to say predictable list. African Americans are not only underrepresented, not only underpaid, not only underemployed, but undereducated. In second class or third class schooling, that in general, the situation of persons of color, despite the successes of civil rights legislation of that era, despite all that, black people and other persons of color really do suffer under this essentially segregationist and isolating situation.
Indeed. The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world.
Right.
Ahead of nations like China, like Iran, all sorts of places that we often criticize as being less than democratic. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. Of that population, of the imprisoned population, it is disproportionately made up of underrepresented people.
Yes.
People of color.
And, of course, a lot of those people are in prison for what is now going to probably become a legal activity, smoking marijuana.
This is very true. Let's just look at the demographics in Ferguson, Missouri. Ferguson is about 63% black, 33% white, 4% other folks. Of all the traffic stops that take place in Ferguson, 86% of them are performed on black citizens. And of all arrests in Ferguson, black suspects make up 92% of those arrests. So what we have here is a white minority that dominates the city government and the law enforcement system, disproportionately arresting citizens of color in their town. Of the 53 commissioned police officers in the Ferguson Police Department, only three are black. So this is almost a cliched example of a white-dominated power structure in a southern community.
Well, actually, in a border state, you know.
In a border state.
Border state.
Well, it is what it is.
Anyway, I think it's really, I really think it is important to understand that a number of things are going on with this case. And also to understand that we're not feeling, at least I'm not feeling, any kind of strong leadership from the President of the United States in this matter.
No.
I don't know whether he's just being even-handed and careful, which is the way he is, or whether, in fact, he is what the more likely is the case. He doesn't want to take identity with the community under siege.
Yes, he has a tendency to try to be even-handed and clear. However, I think it is on issues of race that he often is the most eloquent. You recall that speech he gave in 2008 when campaigning for the presidency? Brilliant speech about race in America. And over the weekend, he talked about young black men being often considered by the mainstream population to be objects of fear. That's pretty direct language. And it's naming an uncomfortable truth that a lot of people don't like to discuss.
Well, I'm going to agree with you. I don't want to get into a dialogue about whether or not Obama is a leader adequate to the situation. I don't know that there could be a leader adequate to the situation. I know there's several things that I did want to get out that are really important. The murder of Martin Luther King, whoever the real murderers were, the murder of Martin Luther King essentially took out a kind of leadership that could respond in, were he alive and were he younger, could respond to an event like this business in Ferguson. I think that essentially we have seen so many elements of fumble and bumble and outright racism in Ferguson, in this situation. One example is the attempt to impose a curfew, the failure to do that effectively, the decision yesterday night to allow everybody to demonstrate, but not allow them to, and this is amazing, not allow them to stand in one place and gather and make speeches.
Yeah, indeed.
And keep moving.
Yeah, the press were confined to a very small area as well and not allowed to shoot footage of the protest at large.
Well, and now the press is being accused by the authorities of being the cause, the stimulator of all this. Meanwhile, and here's where it gets really complicated, the people of Ferguson's reaction, both understandable and perhaps more controlled than I would expect, has been overshadowed by the fact that somebodies, plural, coming from somewhere, probably outside of Ferguson, are engaging in a kind of guerrilla war in the middle of all this. People are being shot, rocks are being thrown, all kinds of resistance is being displayed by allegedly outside, you know, I hate this term, but I don't know what else to call it, outside agitators from somewhere else. And we do know that St. Louis has a large, large population of very poor, very controlled population, particularly in this, in the area called East St. Louis.
In Illinois, actually, right?
No. East St. Louis.
I thought it was over the river.
I'm not sure.
I could be wrong. Okay.
I'm not sure. Not in Illinois in any event.
All right.
Anyway, the thing is that the ability of the community to self-control itself and self-police itself, and under these circumstances grows weaker and weaker as the authorities grow stronger and stronger. Various attempts have been made initially by the local authorities, which were horrendous. Essentially, they militarized the entire situation. They, without real provocation, used tear gas, rubber bullets, beanbags, explosives of various sorts, smoke bombs, incendiaries,
gas,
the new light strobe machines, the new sound machines, all of this sort of crowd control stuff. And this is all part of another issue, which is that the police have been given all over the United States, including Portland, weapons of war.
Yes, indeed.
And they use them.
Yes, they deploy the police routinely in this country in crowd control situations like this, deploy weapons and tactics that until recently were reserved for the military.
Well, I'm not sure totally reserved to the military. They're certainly used to break strikes in the old days.
Well, okay.
But it's all more mechanized and it's all more... All more scientific now, and it is if you have in Portland in the last couple 3 years gone to demonstrations, if you were at Occupy, for example, and the confrontations that took place around the ending of Occupy, you would have seen the police in essentially armor, body armor, facial armor, carrying weapons,
shields,
and using things like pepper spray. One young woman was hit in the she was being rude. And this one officer hit her in the face, right actually in the throat, with pepper spray.
Yes,
so
true.
So I want to be clear about two different things. First of all, there is the enormous militarization and authoritarian fascist-like changes in police generally as part of the cultural norm of things these days. There is also the fact that African Americans are underemployed, undereducated, under-incomed, you know, in many cases even underfed in the United States, and that we are, as a society, totally in denial of all that. There's another factor. The young people involved in all of this, most people, in fact, involved in all of this, or even not involved, did not experience the civil rights struggle. They saw it through the prism of movies, through educational programs in schools that praised nonviolence by Martin Luther King, ignored the fact that King turned against the war in Vietnam and subsequently was murdered.
Well, I think they probably have heard firsthand accounts from friends and relatives also.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. But certainly not in the whole of the city, not in the white communities, perhaps in the black communities.
Now, I want to hear what people think about this issue, both in Ferguson, Missouri, and the sort of larger narrative we're trying to sketch out here.
Well, remember, this takes place in the context of numerous shootings of African-American men by police in the last year.
Indeed. And lest you think that this is something that happens in the old Confederacy, Portland has a rich history of this sort of thing happening, and I use rich very ironically in this case. In the not-too-distant past, as people like Kendra James, James Jahar Perez, Keaton Otis, Aaron Campbell, all of these people, African-Americans, and the victims of police violence here in Portland. So it happens here, just like it happens all over the country.
Right. Okay, I think we should go to the phones. 231-8187.
Dave, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I guess impunity is one of the things that is driving people nuts about this, that cops can murder you and just go back to work, no problem. And part of that, I found myself having an opportunity to be on a grand jury. And I'd heard things about grand juries not good and blah, 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 but I didn't really know what the hell it was. So I went ahead and volunteered to be on the grand jury, and that's one of the issues here. The prosecutor wants to take the case to the grand jury where he could indict the person, the cop himself, but he's a friend of the cops, and he's not going to do that. So he wants to take it to the grand jury, and that sounds like, well, yeah, he's going to put him in front of a jury. But what my experience on the grand jury was that the grand jury kind of operates as a focus group for the prosecutors, for the district attorney. They take a case before this group of seven people and give it a shot and see if people think they've got a case. And almost always they do. The grand jury votes to indict, even though some of those cases are pretty shaky. But I noticed, formally, I think you have to have three of the people on the grand jury can vote not to prosecute, and that's enough. But I noticed that that even if there was one or two of us that were raising questions and objections and being skeptical about it, they didn't prosecute. So they're basically using it as a focus group. And your experience on the grand jury is you come in and you're confused. You know, they're just a bunch of people that can get time off from work or are retired because you have to commit to a month of get up in the morning, show up at 8 or whatever it is, and work until they let you go. Sometimes it's 5. A lot of times it's 2 or 3 in the afternoon, but sometimes it's a long day. So anyhow, you're in there for a month and you start out, and in come these friendly district attorneys, and they bring in cases with cops. And after a while, you start getting to know the district attorneys and the cops and the people that, you know, the victims. They don't bring in the person that's being prosecuted. They just bring the victims, and they just present the prosecution case. So you have this row of victims that are usually from poor communities that have been abused by other poor people that you don't get to know, but you do get to know the prosecutors and the cops. And actually, a couple of the women on the grand jury I was on wanted to have a little vote on who's our favorite cop and who's our favorite DA. Hmm. So, you know, I can see how that's set up. I was wondering, okay, if a cop shoots somebody and they put it in front of this grand jury, how's that going to go? And it's going to go in favor of the cop. No way it could go any other way. That is a culture of your little grand jury is going to be that way. And they probably won't take it to the grand jury until they've stroked the culture of the group of people that are there, just regular citizens. But until they've manipulated us to where we're going to vote their way, and that's what they're trying to do, and that's what's making people so mad. One of the things that's making people mad there, mm-hmm. And I think just generally in the era of neoliberalism, that's what's happening. Is they're preparing for. The idea is as global warming proceeds and things get worse and worse, people are going to be rising up and being mad, and they want to have a military that's ready to stop us, because the future is, you know, look at the Middle East. That's the future. People fighting over less and less. You know, there have been huge droughts and food shortages in the Middle East, and people are upset, and they get pushed into fighting with other people and letting the rich people get off on top.
Okay, I think, Dave, I really appreciate your insight into the grand jury and your comments. We're going to give others an opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's about time for me to shut up.
Okay, man. Hey,
thank you very much.
Sure. All right, 231-8187. We're talking about what's going on in Ferguson. By the way, Eric Holder, the attorney general, will be there. Is it today? Tomorrow, I believe. There are a huge number, 50, I think, something like that, FBI agents on the scene. There, and by the way, if I were talking the language of the current press and the police, I would say on scene, right?
I suppose you would.
We drop all the articles because we're military. In fact, our whole language of policing and discourse has become military. And that's important, because language, bad language, indicates bad faith. Bad faith indicates bad outcomes. And this is a pattern we're seeing more and more in our society, where language is being manipulated to take on a kind of authoritarian context.
I would tend to agree with that.
Yeah. It's pretty, I mean, it's not, I guess it's subtle enough so that people may not notice it, but you have to be old enough to remember when articles still existed in speech.
Well, it's sometimes not so subtle. The war on terror, the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, yeah.
These are all quite Orwellian things that have become commonplace.
You're right. You're right. That's very depressing. But
503. Oh, sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
No, go ahead.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're also taking your comments on Facebook. Facebook.com/Abe and Joe. If you don't want to pick up the phone, you can leave a comment there.
I think that we have seen excellent, by the way, excellent coverage on this, of all things CNN and MSNBC. Obviously, Amy Goodman. I mean, a lot of sources. There's not a lot to criticize in the sense that the press has not been on the case. What there really isn't is a reasonable and understandable pattern here in which the officer who, by any standard, has got to be indictable, if not convictable, in this case of shooting this guy. By the way, the same time that the autopsy results were released, the local police also released videotape alleging to show the victim robbing a convenience store of cigars. But that event was not, by their own admission, not known to the officer who shot the kid. So if he did do it, it's irrelevant.
You really got to question the timing of that. The implication is, he was just a petty criminal.
A bad
kid. So the punishment now for shoplifting is summary execution in the middle of the street? I don't understand that. That I don't know who the PR person working for the Ferguson Police Department is, but they should get fired. Say that again, Engineer Steve.
The Ferguson police did not even get possession of that video until after Michael Brown was dead. The store owner and none of the employees at that store called 911, called the police.
Oh.
The police were called by a bystander that was also in the store.
So
that, and they didn't even, the police that shot Michael Brown didn't even know that that incident had occurred.
So the police didn't need to release that footage. It was irrelevant to the facts of the shooting.
Right.
So you really got to wonder why they did it, if not to cast aspersions on the character of the deceased.
Well, and of course, I guess in the idea is the public mind will say, well, he was a bad kid, so it's okay to murder him. I mean, this is really, really, really a non sequitur, the ultimate example of that.
It is. There's a whole lot of that flying around here. Now, there was a Missouri Highway Patrol captain who was drafted by the governor of Missouri to come in and crack down on the crowds that had been demonstrating all week long.
But also, I think, crack down on the police who had gotten crazy on the first night.
Well, indeed, yes. And Mr. Johnson, this Missouri Highway Patrol captain, blamed the violence and the unrest in Ferguson on what he called, quote, premeditated criminal acts. And that, in my mind, is in this context, is the height of irony. If this man is dead for a what has to be called a premeditated criminal act.
Yes, and there is this mysterious gang of assassins or secret shooters that are somehow operating in Ferguson. And I don't doubt that there are some, I think they're called bad characters or something like that. There are some people who are taking this opportunity to make war on the authorities.
Yes, they are. But you have to, again, examine the context. You know, throwing rocks and fighting back at the police, those are the weapons of people who have few options. That's how you make a social and political point if you are underrepresented and you have few options. If you're rich, you don't need to riot. You don't need to throw stones. You don't need to get in fights with the police because you have all kinds of levers of influence that you can pull on. So let's not forget the fact that while it's never okay to be violent in public and to let your demonstration turn violent, that these are political acts.
Yeah, and I am very curious. I really am very curious about who these persons who shoot from cover are.
Yeah.
And I'm not, first of all, I don't want to suggest that it doesn't happen. I don't want to suggest that it is some kind of a plot by the government or by the law enforcement community. I think it's real, and I think it's a deep part of the incredible tension, disappointment, anger, and eventually rage of African Americans in cities where they have unemployment, where they have under education, where they have under health care, where every element that can make a life decent is denied.
Let's go to the phones. Who's next? Joe, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Hello.
You're on the air.
You can hear me. Okay. You
yes.
Said I should have been the third caller. But anyway, walking down the middle of the street when there are sidewalks makes about as much sense as driving your car on the sidewalk.
Right. Clearly people who should get shot when they rock down the middle of the street.
Now, that's a whole different thing.
Well, actually, I'm going to interrupt you here because I want to make a point about this walking down the middle of the street. And I have seen this as a cultural phenomenon in my life for a long, long time.
It's not wrong.
It would be wrong if you block traffic. It is maybe illegal in the sense that the law says you stay on the sidewalk. But there's nothing in that activity which per se would require anything more if a policeman felt that it was an inappropriate activity than saying, hey, dude, get back onto the sidewalk. That's the extent of the crime involved. It's nothing. And you're trying to make it a something. And I don't even understand why.
Hazard to navigation, you moron.
All right, goodbye.
Well, yeah.
That's weird.
Every hazard to navigation should be dispatched in swift fashion.
Well, I think every pothole should be filled.
Yeah,
or I'm going to talk to the mayor
here.
Filled
with hot lead.
Don't go there. And there was no traffic on the street, just to be clear on this case.
Nobody
was blocking anything.
Let's go back to the phones. Thomas, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Well, I hope that the previous caller's perspective represents a minority, but I think it does serve to highlight a certain important point, is that if we get too wrapped up in the particulars, though they may be important from some sort of a legal perspective for the individual that was killed, we really lose sight of a larger issue. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think it's easy to really live in denial and kind of, you know, about how far down a rabbit hole we've gone towards effectively a police state. I mean, Ferguson, Missouri has many particulars that were predisposed to such situations. But really, you know, you're talking about any town, USA. You know, people who live in upper, you know, white, middle or upper class bubbles who think that it doesn't involve, that it can't affect them are deluded. You know, and as far as a larger picture, you know, I think I can't help but continue to think about for 30 or 40 years now, we've had this bipartisan unanimity on the quote-unquote war on drugs instituted by Nixon, where just year after year, Democrat and Republican politicians try to outbid each other on who can pass the more harsh draconian mandatory minimums, how the police can violate and essentially short circuit the constitutional directions directives against search and seizure, et cetera, right down the line. And you have this hard takedown model that is in tandem with this with the police departments. You have police departments, and what the first caller said about impunity, I think, is directly relevant. You have a situation where across the board, and almost not 2 weeks goes by that we don't hear about some high-profile public outrage about usually a black or brown people getting shot to death in the streets for things that amount to a little more than jaywalking. This is a pattern, you know.
It is
an absolute
yeah.
pattern. And you know, we talk about the police, the fraternal area police, and other police groups essentially act like a mafia to protect. There is impunity. There's absolute legal impunity. Name the last time that a police officer went to jail for a shooting like this. It almost doesn't happen. You know, as far as this idea that attorney Eric Holder, now that everything is the pot has boiled enough, thanks to the protests of people in Ferguson, Missouri, that you know, Obama is issuing pronouncements and Eric Holder is going to go down. These are hollow ceremonies. Think about it. I mean, these are the same people that continue to promote this ridiculous policies of like the Safe Communities Program, which essentially turns the state and local law enforcement into Gestapo-like inquisitors who are feared by the communities they're supposed to serve. You know, this is the same administration who continues to push the Homeland Security fusion centers, continues to in lockstep support this ridiculous model of policing. There is no federal leadership. And you think about that in tandem with the fact that look what's happened to African Americans. Look, in spite of the mess, look at what's happened. Look at what's happened to their wealth ever since the mortgage fraud crisis and the banks who were largely unprosecuted and nobody went to jail. Who were the communities that were centrally targeted? Look at the during this, the black communities. You look at the statistics on how many people lost equity in their homes or lost their homes, overwhelmingly and disproportionately black. So you have people that have nowhere, who fear the police, have absolutely nowhere to turn, and you have this bipartisan conformity. And ironically, you know, you get people like Obama and Holder, and there's this false hope because they should have sensitivity from being African Americans. Well, unfortunately, guess what? It's not the W.E.B. Du Bois and the Martin Luther Kings who are matriculating through the political process. It's a bunch of go-along to get along political conformists, you know, a bunch of calculating, don't rock the boat political opportunities, seeking their own self-aggrandizement. Ironically, you know, people like Obama and Holder are there as they're the least likely people to promulgate, you know, anything for the African community.
Okay, I think I agree with you, yeah, but I think that's, we're going to have to leave that particular point.
But this goes back to my previous point. Institutional racism is alive and well. It has not gone away, despite the progress made over the years. It's still a big problem, and you still see people of color dead at the hands of white policemen who ultimately face little or no consequence.
Well, yeah, you see it all over the country. Yep. In California, you've seen it recently. In New York City, Staten Island.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, here in Portland.
And Portland.
Matt writes to the Abe and Joe Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/Abe and Joe. He writes, FYI, East St. Louis is indeed in Illinois, but I doubt that's where the so-called outside agitators come from, since basically nobody lives there anymore. It's almost a ghost town at this point.
Yeah, and so much so that I don't even know where it is.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, on alternative radio, writer Paul Ehrlich speaks on distress signals from Earth. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a Palestinian journalist talks about the prospects for peace in Gaza. Also, Flashpoints continues coverage of the escalating campaign by the U.S.-backed government in Haiti against former President Aristide, and a closer look at reporter James Risen's claim that President Obama is the greatest enemy to press freedom in a generation. At 11 on stage and studio, guest host Sarika Mehta interviews Simon Tam, the bassist of Portland's very own Chinatown dance rock band, The Slants. Wow. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake's guest is Ellen L'Esperance, who has a show coming up in September at Adams and Ullman. This will be Ava's last show as host.
Oh, no.
She's been around for a long
time. She's cool lady.
Very cool lady. All this and more coming up today on your listener-supported radio station, KBOO.
Yeah, and I want to add, we need your money, so stop screwing around with it and just give it to us.
That was eloquently stated.
Oh, yeah, I'm real eloquent today, let me tell you.
Who wouldn't hand over their cash to you after a request like that?
Right.
No,
right.
Seriously, we depend on your contributions to make the station go. So if you do navigate over to that website, kboo.fm, click on the tip jar and leave a contribution, please.
Yeah, all right. So, all right. What we are talking about, if you're just tuning in here at KBOO 90.7, your FM dial, is the behavior in reaction to the murder of a young man by the police in Ferguson, Missouri. And what we are also looking at is the question of what is appropriate crowd control, how do we allow free speech. I want to make a clear point. I said it earlier, but it's really important. Under the leadership of a relatively benign and intelligent African American who's head of the state patrol in the area, there was to be a no curfew last night, but people could demonstrate, but they were supposed to keep moving. Now, I don't know what your definition of First Amendment freedom is, but the Constitution clearly says you get to gather, you know, you get to petition for your grievances. Making people walk around endlessly in a pointless oval is not the same as allowing them to gather and to petition. It is a parody of free speech. And the consequence of that, of course, was that it all broke down very quickly. There are these alleged outside agitators. Apparently people were shot. A large number of people were arrested, relatively speaking, last night. And including, by the way, a Holocaust-surviving older woman who just said she just couldn't stand this anymore, so she got involved. I think that the whole concept of allowing the people to gather and to petition for their grievances has been ignored in this process, even though there's a more benign or seemingly more benign leader of the police organizations. It's benign only when you compare it to the insane behavior, the highly militarized viciousness of the police in Ferguson following the murder of the young man.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Or you can also leave a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Who's next? Larry, good morning.
Hey, good morning, gents. I think Joe just touched on this. Part of the what we hear about all the military hardware going to the local police forces around the country, but a lot of these police forces are also recent war veterans. That's where most of these guys get their jobs in law enforcement, and they bring their battlefield experiences to downtown, small-town America, and that's part of the blowback of being in war for as many years as we have been. And it basically, I think they all come in with this us-versus-them attitude, and them is us citizens, and there's just a complete disconnect between the police force and the citizens. And I don't think, as recent war veterans and They can understand the difference between, say, us and some Afghani or some Iraqi that they were just fighting 2 months before they got their job in downtown Portland or wherever.
Well, I don't want to disparage the police collectively and their motives, but I do think that you're making a good point that we have created a culture of enormous militaristic insensitivity, and we do see that one of the logical jobs is obviously to go into law enforcement. What other skills do many of these veterans have? I also think that the militarization of the police is not a coincidence and not an accident. That the militarization of the police is a process which is undertaken in what I call a proto-fascist or friendly fascist environment, which is what I think the United States is becoming more and more. I also think that if you were an African-American, I can only speculate, I'm not, if you were an African-American living in Portland, Oregon, you could probably name innumerable incidents of small insult or large insult that you have undergone. And I know from my own research that the history of the African-American community in Portland is a history of insult and of physical movement and disruption and so on. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call, man.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Engineer Steve has just notified us that Ferguson's police chief underwent crowd control training in Israel 3 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
I imagine that's probably pretty cutting-edge crowd control training.
Yeah.
Also, Corey writes to the show at facebook.com/Abe and Joe to say that, so per that recent caller, black males need to get shot and killed for walking down the street, buying tea and Skittles, breathing, wearing a watch, not doing anything at all. Yeah, if you listen to that caller a few callers back, that was the implication, that he was obstructing traffic, so he needed to be shot.
Even though there was no traffic, even.
Right. Well, I'm not sure why.
Well, I don't.
That's part and parcel with the police department in Ferguson releasing that video of the young man, Mr. Brown, in that convenience store.
Maybe Mr. Brown.
What is the point there? The man was shot and killed. So to suggest somehow that by being in the middle of the street, that maybe it's not so out of bounds that he was shot because he was in the middle of the street, or it's not so out of bounds that he was shot because he happened to have been in that convenience store around the time a robbery took place, that he may or may not have been involved in the robbery itself. All this is nonsense. The man is dead. This is the United States of America. You do not deserve to be shot either for shoplifting or for walking down the middle of the street. Those should be able to carry on with your life.
Well, I don't know. I think we should have more capital crimes.
I think you're nuts. 503-231-8187. Who's next, Steve? Paul, good morning.
Good morning. So, an African-American friend of mine, a couple of presidential elections back, got upset with Al Sharpton in one of the debates and says it's not about race, it's about class. And it's about the creation of the other. Gaza, Ferguson, it's all training for end-stage capitalism. Coker was another police chief that went to Israel, and look what we ended up with when he came back, all these militarized, that's when we had the militarized police, and then we had police-instigated police riots at, when we were out there exercising our First Amendment.
You're talking about 99 and the police riot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, the guy brought up the thing, you know, the mortgage crisis. Yeah, that's part of the thing, you know. It's was poor people, and when it started, when it's been going on for a while, it was against black people and communities of color. And then when the white people started getting, losing their homes, then it became the mortgage crisis. So my point is that we're not talking about that this is, you, Joe alludes to it once in a while, this is the capitalism system, and it's not so much that it's a conspiracy. It's like Michael Rupert says, they understand what's in their common interest. They don't have to conspire, they understand. And we're setting up end-stage capitalism, but we probably will shift to fascism, and that's why they're learning all these tactics. There's no longer a left in this country. You know, there's not any nonviolent resistance to empire going on.
Mm-hmm.
And to make matters worse, there's a Measure 90 going on the ballot. Somebody was talking, you know, some people are talking about lately that the Working Families Party says shills for the Democrats. Well, the Measure 90 will be, there won't be any third parties on the ballot because it'll either be two Republicans or two Democrats or once in a while a Republican.
Well, what is Measure 90? I don't think I'm clear on that.
Oh, my God.
All right, let's, we'll tackle that at another time.
I think what we need to do is get into that another time.
Measure 90 is a blanket primary.
I don't want to get into that.
The Oregonian is for it, so you know it's bad.
Okay, man.
Hey, listen, thank you for the call.
Thanks.
But we need the discussion on capitalism.
Yes, I'm going to address that.
It's about class. It's about it, class.
I'm going to address that right now. Thank you very much for the call. That's very important point in this. I am.
You're going to address capitalism right now.
I am. Yes, absolutely. We exist in a capitalist system, and the people most often at the business end of capitalism are the poor, those who are unrepresented in either the political or the economic process. Where we get into issues of race, and where we have always gotten into issues of race in this country, is when those two categories, poor and person of color, overlap, and they disproportionately overlap, and they have throughout the history of this country, going back, of course, to the time when African Americans were not even citizens at all, but pieces of property, not eligible for political representation or participation or economic participation beyond the value that their labor produced. And really, the value of that labor cannot be overstated when you look at the history of this country. Now, where does race come into all of this? Well, it comes in, as I just mentioned, when these two categories overlap, and it has also been used politically over the decades in this country as a lever, particularly in the Old South. Now, the fact of the matter is that for a long time, even going back to the Civil War, poor white folks and poor black folks in the South have had more in common than they have had apart from one another. They have much more occasion to make common cause than they do to oppose one another. But race has been used as a lever to separate those two groups. The white power structure has been able to look at poor whites and say, hey, you may be really bad off, but at least you're not black. And as crude as that might sound, that has been the political and economic hammer that the racist white power structure in the South has swung for a long, long time. And you see that playing out even today in Ferguson, Missouri, as a tiny white minority dominates city government, dominates law enforcement in that town, and disproportionately cracks down upon people of color.
Yeah, I mean, I want to go back to the facts of the matter in Ferguson. If this officer had been indicted, none of this rioting, none of this anger, none of this crisis behavior would have happened.
Yeah,
there would have been some reaction, of course, and there should be, but the anger, the outrage, the hopeless sensation that people feel in this context is due incredibly to the way in which policing was carried out and to the way in which the authorities responded to this murder.
Yeah.
And it is murder. I'm not going to mince words here. When an unarmed man is shot in the middle of the street for doing, as far as the officer who shoots him knows, nothing, that's murder.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear from some more people. Paula, you're
Paula,
on
good
the
morning.
Air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm in town from Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And I have a couple comments. One is the grand jury issue. I just retired from the courts in Minneapolis, and the grand jury issue, I kind of disagreed with the previous caller. I mean, it's mandated by the state law, first of all, what has to be brought in front. It isn't like, oh, there's a cop shooting, should we bring it or not? It's mandated. Secondly, my experience with those jurors was phenomenal. They put their heart and soul into making this decision. Does the prosecution have enough to bring this to court?
Mm-hmm.
And these are real live, you know, both sides politically, economically. I mean, it's completely random how they're chosen. And so I just wanted to say, I think the grand jury is a wonderful legal instrument, and this man made it sound a little bit more like it was more random.
Well,
secondly,
yeah, go ahead.
Secondly, the other piece about the guy with, you know, walking down the street versus the sidewalk, I would first of all get a life, and secondly, I wonder, is he like against abortion, but okay to shoot somebody walking down the street?
That's a very good question. I would like to hear the answer to that question.
I would love to hear that answer myself. Otherwise, I love your show, and I will listen more when I'm in Minnesota.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Thanks a lot for your call.
You can be our Minnesota bureau chief.
By the way, it varies from state to state as to whether or not the grand jury is required for indictment. I think you knew that, but I just want to make
people thank you very much for the call.
Thank you very much for the call. All right, 231-8187. We're talking about Ferguson because we just can't not talk about Ferguson.
BJ, you're on the air. Good morning.
I want to go to Minnesota. It sounds good there.
Oh, they got black flies and stuff, man.
We've come from into a right area here. Liberals are gone. And so the armories are filling up with all kinds of heavy equipment from the war. Got two tanks in the armory behind me.
Really?
Yeah, they're going to be there. They don't know what to do with this stuff. You can't sell it because...
I want a tank. Wait a minute. Yeah. Can I buy a tank? It would be so cool. Think of my power. Think of my neighbor's sickliness.
If or I had a tank. We can have like annual tank races.
We can have tank races. We could sing Tanks for the Memory. I mean, it could be good. All right.
M1 Abrams tank that cost $1 million each when they were cheap. They give them away now.
Oh, I'm going to put in my application.
That ISI has been using them against our forces. They left them over there, I understand.
Well, that's true.
The trouble is they build too much military hardware. And, I don't want to cast aspersions on the Defense Department because I was in the Army for 8 years. However, it's different now. It's a big financial thing against the taxpayer to get enough money to build all this equipment and then to use it against who? There is really no enemy except the one that's inside of ourselves.
Well, I think you're raising an important point. I think when we talk about the militarization of the police, we're not just talking about the incredible display of weaponry and technology, but the attitude that goes with that. When you put on armor, you're putting on something that goes right to the heart of your mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to thank you, BJ. It's good that you called.
Good. See you guys.
Take care.
Someone just sent us a wonderful quote to our Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep mentioning this page, you know.
Yeah, well, you push it.
Yes.
technology.
Facebook.com/Abe and Joe.
Yeah.
John posted this quote. Here it is. There's a reason you separate military and the police. One fights the enemies of the state. The other serves and protects the people. When the military becomes both, then the enemies of the state tend to become the people. You know who said that?
No.
Commander Adama from Battlestar Galactica said that.
Oh, for goodness sake.
All right. 503-231.
No real person said that.
8187.
That's a script.
There was a writer who wrote that. But that's wise, man.
Well, okay.
Who's next? Oh. Who's next, Steve? Linda, good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Great. Just a short comment. I'm pretty sure at this point of my life, of 53, I'm living in the most racist country in the world. And I walk down on the street on a regular, in the middle of the street on a regular basis as a single woman alone, sometimes in the evening. I think we should be racing the tanks down the middle of the street right now, and this guy should be indicted. The policeman should be indicted. And when are we going to rise up? When are we going to rise up as a nation against the amount of weapons that are on the street that obviously scare the shit out of the cops and make them kill people because they're so paranoid?
Okay, well, thanks for the call. I don't disagree.
Yeah, that's great. Tank racing, you heard it here first.
Yeah, I think it's better than destruction derby.
Yeah, I think
bigger,
you're right.
Louder,
yeah.
And more deadly. All right, 231-8187. We're really getting far afield here. Bring us back to the topic. We're trying to talk about Ferguson and about the tragedy that took place there, and about the reaction of the communities there and the reaction of the authorities.
Tom, you're next.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess I have issues around you closing down that. I guess it was the second caller that said that the guys were walking in the street. You know, it reminds me of you know, not letting people express themselves. Yes, it was absurd. Yes, I disagree. But, you know, you didn't allow him a chance to go down his street and maybe let us hear some of the stuff that's supporting that insanity.
Tom, I got to tell you that it was our intention to do so. But then he called us morons, and we decided to end it there because essentially at that point the conversation has degraded to a level that really
is not helpful
to anybody.
I hate to be called a moron. You know how it is, man. I'm very biased on these things.
But you are living in a glass house, and people are going to throw stones, and I think you have to be able to say, okay, why are we morons? What justifies this
okay,
view?
I don't want to. Now I don't want to cut you off because you'll just say see. But here's the deal, man. And listen. This is an important point that people don't understand. And it's not about fair. It's about trying to control a dialogue and trying to present as many ideas as possible. And that wasn't going anywhere from my perspective.
We also try to preserve a certain level of civility. I'm not going to state unequivocally whether or not Joe or I are morons. We might very well be morons. That's for you to decide.
However, I know I'm a moron. I've been graded.
However, in the course of conversation on this program, we're not going to tolerate name-calling and insults and demeaning comments. And that's where that had gone. So
I also think there's an important point about the term moron, which is part of the language used to disenfranchise persons who were allegedly less intelligent than other persons. As a matter of fact, I had the privilege working for a while for Willamette Week years and years ago, and I did a story about what the state was doing to sterilize persons who were regarded as less intelligent than others and how unfair that was. And in fact, the law got changed. I don't know if it had anything to do with our article, but we did that. And I really don't like terms like moron or idiot or a lot of language like that that disenfranchises and delegitimizes people who are differently abled. And I think it's an important point. Anyway, that's what I did.
Okay. I think that moron came up to me. My perception was it came up as the receiver was going down on the hang-up.
Well, it's probably true. Go ahead.
I guess I think that there was an opportunity to dig into this point of view, and I think that was lost. And I understand your reasoning and your thought. But I think we lost an opportunity to touch into that craziness that is going on in Missouri right now.
I think you're right.
I think that's a good criticism. Point. I think I appreciate it. I think we'll stick around for another show next week, and I think I'm going to be on Friday just by myself.
All right.
No, Abe, you don't get to do it.
No. Nope.
And I hope you'll stay tuned. I hope you'll support KBOO. I hope you recognize what great music programming we have.
Thanks, everybody, for your calls this week.
Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor
Negative Land.
Performing live Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
We got so much power.
How many time zones there are in the Soviet Union?
Since 1980, Negative Land has been creating records, CDs, video, fine arts, books, radio, and live performance using appropriated sounds, images, objects, and text.
Negative Land will be performing with Daniel Mensch and Cascadian Knights. All ages welcome.
Not even funny.
Again, that's Negative Land, Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The loudspeaker spoke up and said, "Christianity is stupid."
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9:01. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, writer Paul Ehrlich speaks on distress signals from Earth. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a Palestinian journalist talks about the prospects for peace in Gaza. Also, Flashpoints continues coverage of the escalating campaign for the U.S.-backed government in Haiti against former President Aristide. And a closer look at reporter James Risen's claim that President Obama is the greatest enemy to press freedom.